Welcome to the presentation on what I'm calling the Progress Myth Detectives. Although in this case, I think I may be the only detective here, but I did call on some other people to get some other myths to add to this. So, and the inspiration for this was a program that my wife and I really like called the History Detectives on PBS. I don't know if you've ever seen that. They go through various historical things that people assume are this way and attempt to disprove them, and they're pretty good at it. That series has been out for like 10 years now or so. So anyway, a little bit about myself, because I was at lunch with somebody who didn't realize I'd used Progress for 30 years. This is my, like, in September will be my 30-year anniversary of using Progress as a product. So, and I've only been married for 31 years, so that's kind of, not sure what I'm married to now. Anyway, I'm the author of some books and some products, and I'm also, some of you may know or not know, I'm kind of an old guy, but I love playing basketball, and I'm also an avid biker, and unfortunately that sometimes leaves me in bad shape. So the two on the right are bicycle accidents. The lower right was a really bad one, but you'll notice the little circle there. In each bike accident, I had a Progress t-shirt on. So I'm highlighting the Progress logo. You can't really see it that well. And this is, you notice the Donald Duck surgical mask here? I basically had my head cracked against somebody and I had like 7 stitches there. Anyway, so.
But the shirt survived every time, right?
Yeah, after, you know, a little bit of bleach to get the blood out, yeah. So actually, I just ordered this bike. It should be actually waiting for me when I get home so I don't have to worry about falling over anymore. It's called a recumbent trike if you're a bike aficionado. They're really nice, actually.
Hard to see when you're driving.
This is probably, well, a little bit lower than your average, yeah, average bike, but that's okay. I like the stability and the comfort. So anyway, so when I went to get the definition of mythology, I went to Wikipedia, and they came up with this really verbose mess. So then I went to dictionary.com, and that came out a little bit better. And it's the second bullet is probably the one that I felt was most appropriate for what we're going to talk about. A widely held, but at the same time, false belief or idea or concept. And then folklore kind of has a sort of a similar connotation. And again, Wikipedia gives you the ultra-verbose version. And dictionary.com has a little bit more concise one. Essentially, a body of popular myth and beliefs. So I'm going to share a few of those and some other stuff as well. In fact, to make things interesting and perhaps amusing, I've mixed in some half-truths and truths with the myths. And some of these might even be controversial. If you want to take issue with me, that's fine. This is not designed to be, you know, me telling you how to do something or what's true and what isn't. So it's mostly oriented around the database, but there is a little programming stuff involved toward the latter half. So in no particular sequence, this myth is one that really irritates me because it's been propagated by even some folks at Progress Software themselves. And that is, if you go to type 2 storage areas, you don't have to dump and load your database anymore. And so when I hear this, I usually come back and say, okay, does that mean that fragmentation is no longer occurs in a type 2 storage area? And so with regard to scatter factor, yes, type 2 is a major milestone in keeping data physically contiguous compared to the legacy type 1 storage areas. But as far as fragmentation goes, a fragmented record is still a fragmented record, whether it's in type 1 or type 2. So that's something that I won't say only a dump and load will fix, but in general, a dump and load is the most convenient way of fixing that. Then another one that's kind of a legacy one, that I've even purported myself, much to my chagrin on occasion, and that is setting a records per block to a value of 1 for index-specific storage areas. Now, the reason for the records per block 1 in the first place was that allows the absolute largest size of a storage area to grow in no matter what version of Progress you're talking about. But back in the version 9 era, before we got into 64-bit DB keys and so forth, there was really some big limitations on how large Progress databases could grow. So people would say, well, indexes don't have records in them, so the records per block doesn't really have any meaning. But at the same time, I have to give it some value for an index array. So let's give it 1, because that allows the array to grow to its maximum possible value, if it does need to. So in that regard, it was a somewhat sound recommendation. But this actually happened to a customer. It's a true story, several years old, but still true. A developer was adding a new table to the database, and they accidentally put it into an index storage area that had an RPB of 1. Now, that doesn't break anything, but it makes the database grow really, 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 really fast, because you can only put 1 record per block with an RPB of 1, as opposed to 64 or 128 or even 32 or something, or 16. So anyway, their database was growing really, 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 really fast, and they called us, and we found it fairly quickly. It was hard to miss, actually. So you can use an RPB of 1 if you could guarantee that no one will ever put a table into that storage area. I don't know if you can guarantee such a thing so easily. Anyway, the next item. This is kind of a current...
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
About that? So it really doesn't matter your RPB for an index area, so...
From the aspect of what it contains. In other words, Progress fills up index blocks as full as it can.
So we have separated our data in index areas. We have an index area for every data area. So if we set them exactly the same, that would actually be...
That's what I tend to do. I tend to make them symmetrical. So if I've got data area at 64, I'll set my index area at 64.
Okay.
Yes,
Mr. B. I would assume the reason for the 1 records per block was so that you could have a flatter index tree. If you have more data nodes, more nodes in a particular block, it's a longer time when the index expands before you have to go to another level.
Yeah, I don't think RPB has anything to do with that. That's a function of the database block size. But I think Mr. Banville's back there.
I agree.
He was shaking his head as well.
Tom's statement is incorrect.
Okay, all right. Well, good. That's why I hope some of these would provoke some conversation. So we've already done that. So anyway, data cluster size of 8 for index areas. That's been kind of propagated for a while. And actually, before the conference last week, I spent a little bit of time with Mr. Rich Banville back there and talking about this very topic. And essentially, his recommendation is to have no less than a cluster size of 64 for index areas. And it has to do with, well, it's a relatively complex explanation that might take a little more time than I want to devote to it. But essentially, take his word for it, not mine. Yes, Mike.
However, a lot of the applications that I work with, QAD would be an example of this, have many, many tables that have 0 records in them, and many, 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 many indexes that have 0 records in them. How would a data cluster size of 64 affect a whole bunch of, I'm talking 500, 600, 0 entry indexes?
Okay, well, that basically means that you're gonna have, let's see, 64 minus 8 is 56. You're gonna have 56 blocks per object that doesn't have any data in it for that area. In other words, the difference between an RPB of 8 and 64.
Right. If you have lots of indexes that have no data in them, then this doesn't matter. The reason to make it 64 has to do with the way that the indexes are being updated. So if your indexes have no data in them, then they don't apply.
Good point. But hopefully there are some indexes that do have data in them. Although, I have a little program that I run when I go to customer sites. This is kind of a little bit of an aside, but that searches for a couple of things. It searches for tables in index areas and indexes in tables, but it also looks for objects like tables or indexes in the schema area. And what I find frequently is people are very diligent about creating indexes and tables in different areas, But sometimes they'll create a table with no index. And in that case, Progress creates an index called the default index, and guess where it goes? Into the schema area. So I find that quite frequently for, you know, it's like, well, this table isn't big enough to add an index. I always just do a find first on it. Well, there's still an index. It's just not an index that you created. Well, anyway. All right, last one. This is probably going to raise some conversation, and that is the classic, I'll call it a classic, argument of should I use a 4K block size or an 8K block size, or stated in another way, should I match the database block size to the file system block size or not? So the argument for matching them goes to this art thing of called torn pages. So if your database block size is larger than your file system block size, so let's say 8K for the database, 4K for the file system, that means for every I/O, like let's say we're writing a database block to disk, that means that there's two file system blocks involved, right? 4 + 4 = 8. And so you've got essentially two operations that have to coalesce that block and write it out to the database on disk. Well, most modern servers, the overhead of doing that is relatively low. Where things can happen or can go wrong is if something goes wrong between the writing of block number one and the writing of block number two. So block number one gets written successfully, block number two gets aborted for some reason, then you've got what's sometimes called a torn page. If you think of blocks as pages, as they're referred to in some databases like SQL Server. So if you want to guarantee, well, I won't say guarantee, but let's say improve the probability that you'll never have a torn page, then you would match the database block size to the file system block size. But to me, the odds of that happening are tiny. Number one, it requires a failure of some kind, and it requires that failure to occur at exactly that moment of time between the operation of two blocks being written. So that's kind of the requirement to make it happen. And the other thing is, if you're not using 8K for your database block size, you're giving up things like, the smaller the block size, the fewer records you can store, the fewer index keys you can store, the fewer blob and or clob type objects you can store within the same block. So you're giving up a little bit of storage, well, actually 50% of storage, 8K compared to 4K. So there's really two philosophies here. I wouldn't criticize anybody for doing either of them, but my own personal preference is to always go with 8K. Yes?
So if you have a torn page, you will get a CRC error on a type 2 storage area or something like that. Has anybody ever seen this error? So I was just curious to see how often a torn page is than ever.
Well, he's not here to speak for himself, but George Potemkin claims to have seen one.
I've seen one.
With one of his customers.
I've seen one with one of our customers, but I've only seen it once. I'm curious to see if anybody else has ever seen it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think they're pretty rare. And the other thing is, if something that bad happened, you're probably going to have other things that have happened as well, not just that particular torn page. But anyway. All right, so let's continue on this. We're kind of talking about storage a little bit, but now let's go more to the devices that are holding the database. So this is one of the favorite terms I've heard, not terms or phrases I've heard over the years, is Progress doesn't work well with RAID 5. It's like everybody else does, apparently. But only Progress doesn't work well with RAID 5. So I have no idea where that one came from. But I think what happens a lot of times is people use RAID 5 on web servers and email servers and stuff like that, and they don't have any issues, and they say, well, our database is in Progress and things are slow and this consultant says it's RAID 5 and that's the problem, so why doesn't Progress like RAID 5? Well, the problem is you're talking about two different entities, a database which does a lot of writes and read type activity versus something where the write activity is probably relatively low in comparison. But anyway, that's where I think these things come from. Yes?
I have a question specific to RAID 5. Is that also true for binary dump and loads that RAID 5 impacts the database?
I wouldn't say so much for a load, yes, because you're writing to the database, and for a dump because you're writing the dump file to the database.
Okay.
And also if you're doing backups to disk. That's where people really tend to feel it, is because you're writing an entire database to a file on a RAID 5 volume. That's where you'll really feel it, probably more than any other activity.
I've got basically a load that I tried to do last week. It took 36 hours on the server at a very big client that shall remain nameless, not admitting they were on RAID 5, but I found out that they were. And,
was like a secret society or something? RAID 5 society.
It's a big bank. And my experience was I did a benchmark of the exact same data footprint, same database on my laptop, and it was 3 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah, well, in general, most consultants will agree that RAID 5 is evil.
But it's not their server. The problem's not their server.
No, it's not the server, it's the storage.
Storage.
I mean, so they could actually say that truthfully if the, you know, if the, you know, the storage is in a different box.
Right.
But anyway, then another myth I hear related to RAID 5 is, well, and these are usually coming from salespeople of storage devices, and so, well, our RAID 5 is better because we have cache. And like in the case of EMC, I've seen hundreds of gigabytes of cache. And you pay a lot for EMC cache, as probably well as other high-end storage vendors' cache. Well, sure, cache does blunt the impact of RAID 5, but at the same time, how much is enough? Well, the same guys that are saying our cache, you know, our RAID 5 is better, they'll be happy to sell you as much cache as they think you need. And also, it's still a finite resource, though. If your database is a terabyte and you've got 100 gigabytes of cache, you're still going to come up short. Possibly, depending on how much of the database is touched during a given time period. So then the last item is, okay, I've got lots of caching going on. I've got database cache. I've got file system cache. And if I'm using a storage device, I probably have cache there as well. So where should I put my money? Or in the case of the server, should I allocate more to system cache, less to the database, or not? And I wish Tom was here, Tom Bascom. He did a test of this, I think a couple years ago, and ascertained that getting data from the database cache is, I can't remember what the exact numbers were, but I think it was like hundreds of times faster than any of the other caches. And Tom's pretty good about doing benchmarks. I generally trust ones that he does. So in general, I believe that his conclusion, and I would agree with it, is that the database cache is the best use of cache. So don't ever surrender the database cache to other things, whether they be monetary or competing items on the same server. So then continuing on with RAID levels. So I'll tell you, there are people who believe this. They believe that the RAID levels are numerically aligned. So RAID 0 must be worthless. Well, RAID 0 is called RAID 0 because it offers no degree of redundancy. RAID 0 is basically striping. RAID 1 is mirroring, and anyway, it goes on from there. I haven't memorized all the RAID levels. But there are people that think, well, RAID 1 is good, but wow, RAID 5 must be 5 times better. But that means RAID 10 is, you know, another amount better. And then RAID 6, of course, is better than RAID 5. Oh, anyway, RAID levels are, I wish they hadn't picked numbers, whoever did this way back in the 80s, because they have nothing to do with the quality of the storage or the redundancy that's being offered. So there's also a new one out fairly recently called RAID 50. So that means obviously it's 5 times better than RAID 10 and 10 times better than RAID 5. I mean, you know, how could you go wrong? But you really got to look deeply into these things and find out what they're really talking about. Because there's another one out there where they did remove the number. NetApp has this thing called RAID DP. So, oh, we took away the number, so now people have no clue what we're doing. And we'll call it double parity, which is essentially, you call it RAID 5 multiplied. RAID 5 squared, maybe that's what they should call it. So, anyway. Now, there are some myths, I'll call them contrary myths, because there's, I'll call it the classic version, and then there's the more contemporary version. And it has to do with the philosophy related to should I use fixed extents for my database, as some people do and are very passionate about, or I have very fast storage and I don't like to spend time on maintenance, so I won't use fixed extents at all. So, which is right? Well, actually, I think you can make cases for both. So if you want the absolute best performance, you probably would adhere to the classic version, you know, which is to use fixed extents or limit your growth to fixed size data extents whenever possible. But one of my customers who has a, last time I talked to him, it's been a year or so, has a 4 terabyte database, they pretty much gave up on fixed extents. Or they might have one fixed extent just to kind of take care of the gross part of the data, but everything else, they don't mind if it grows into the variable extent. But having said that, they tend to have very high quality storage devices, so the performance impact doesn't get them. But it isn't all about performance. I think sometimes we tend to focus on performance and miss some of the other implications of fixed versus variable. So for example, AI extents. Tomorrow morning, Gus and I are going to give a presentation on after imaging notes. And the way you can look at notes is run a particular RFUtil command which scans through an AI file and produces some output. Well, if you've got AI logs that are, you know, gigabytes in size, the output of the scan command is going to be even more gigabytes in size for you to wade through and try to figure out things. So in that example, if you prize that kind of analytical capability, then smaller fixed extents would probably be a better fit for you. Or Mike mentioned an example to me that he ran into recently where one of our customers had a corrupted database and he needed to run one of the scan utilities against a particular part of the database. And in the case of a large variable extent, that could take a really long time as opposed to smaller individual fixed extents. So don't let the performance aspect of fixed versus variable kind of cloud you. There's other aspects to it. And you had a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say, we switched to mostly all variable extents, and one of our problems was we connect to so many databases at a time, we were running out of file descriptors with fixed extents because they're all connected at the same time.
Ah, good point. So.
And on the other side, we've been running mostly smaller fixed only because we found the big performance on the system to reduce file system contention was key when you have lots of things trying to happen at once. So it was better to break things up into smaller file systems, and thus you want to be able to fill a 100 gig file system, so you want fixed extents to fill that nicely, okay, and have lots of those, and then you reduce the file system contention, which was really the bigger factor overshadowing everything else.
So what's the verdict? I think we're all right, so. But at least know why you're doing it. A lot of times I'll go into a customer site and say, why are you doing this like this? Because that's the way we've always done it. That's probably not the right answer. Okay, let's go into some tuning myths. Now this first one I don't hear very often anymore because most customers don't shut down their databases every day. But I have one customer in the UK, as it turns out, that they felt that they needed to do a cold restart of the database every day because they were afraid of something, some amorphous, undefinable fear that they had. Well, eventually we talked them out of it because the business basically said, hey, we need to be up 24/7, and so get over it. So they brought me in to kind of convince the team to get over it. But anyway, but I've heard people tell me that we must truncate the BI file daily to maintain good performance. I said, well, show me. And anyway, when they try to show you, then you can't see the difference. So it's probably, it's mythology. It may have coincidentally been something at the same time, and truncating the BI just happened to be at that time, and things were better. But
it must have changed the BI cluster at the same time.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But they don't tell you that. So. And as a corollary to that is or a companion to that is, I've got to truncate the BI file, maybe not daily, but frequently. Well, if the BI file grows rapidly beyond kind of a normal size, then I can see a good case for truncation. But other than that, it takes time, you know, and that time is valuable in the case where you need to, you know, bring a database down and back up as quickly as possible. Or, but on the other, but again, on the flip side, the larger the BI file, the longer crash recovery can take. The larger the BI file, the more disk space crash recovery can take. So again, there's some contrary points there. So like I said, this is some of these are just trying to provoke thought more than they are to say, do this or do that. But the third bullet is definitely a myth. Taking the number of CPUs, or probably more contemporarily, the number of cores you have, and multiply them by 10,000, and that will give you the perfect value of spin. Well, we have a few customers that have more than 100 cores. So if you take 100 and multiply it by 10,000, you end up with a spin value of fairly big proportions, and not necessarily that good. So this might have been appropriate, I don't know, maybe in the 90s when CPUs were fewer in number. But spin actually is a very gross way of tuning, because you have to realize that every latch inside of shared memory could potentially have its own spin value, because the latches are all used for different things at different times and in different ways. So in the perfect world, there'd be a spin per latch. So really, spin is already a gross kind of setting, because that setting applies to every latch, big, small, active, not so active, and so forth. So, I mean, if you want a thing to get you in the ballpark, I say 10,000 probably isn't bad, but the more CPUs you have, the less interesting or accurate or probable that spin is really going to produce a good value for you with that calculation. Then another one is the set the big B to 10% of your database size. Well, we have one customer who has a database of about 7 terabytes. So 10% of that would be 700 gigabytes, which is more physical memory than their server contains. So what do they do? But it's one of those get you started numbers, I think. It's not supposed to be a recommendation. If you don't have any other clue as to what to set it to, brand new system, no history, you don't know how it's going to operate, sure, try the 10%. But at the same time, realize you're going to probably want to change it very, very quickly after that. Then the next one. This one actually came from Gus, and he admitted to it, said I could use his name in vain. And it's still in some of the older progress documentation books, if you still have the book versions. It says, start one APW for every database disk, physical disk, plus one. Well, so again, if you've got a SAN with 100 disks in it, and the database is striped across those 100 disks, that's a lot of APWs to start. So again, that's not a good number. Probably the generally agreed upon number is probably somewhere between 1 and 4. How many people disagree with that number? Oh, one person, okay. Let's chat about that later. And Gus said that actually he felt that that was a valid number, but it was in an era back in the version 6, version 7 era when a platform called Sequent still existed. And they don't really exist anymore. They were assimilated by IBM several years ago. Another one that Gus put out that he agrees is no longer applicable in the modern architecture progress is, and again, you'll still find this in the documentation, is taking your BI buffs, multiplying it by 1.5 to get the AI buffs. Now, the good news is even if you do that, it's not going to be a huge loss of memory, because most people don't set their BI buffs to crazy numbers. But it's still memory that you could be using for other activities. So in general, I set them equal to each other, and that's worked very well for me. All right, another myth, and I know Mike is going to, I asked Mike for some ideas for this presentation, and he said, well, direct IO, I don't think so. But I have to disagree with you on that. But that's why I like these. So anyway, first of all, direct IO, when it was originally implemented back in version 6, only was applicable to Data General and Sequent, which are two platforms that don't really exist anymore. But the documentation wasn't really updated quickly enough, because starting in version 8, DirectIO applies to all platforms. Whether it's good or not is a different story, but it is usable or applicable on every Progress database. So, but then something happened with Progress around late version 9 and early version 10, where the way that Progress writes to the database was changed, or the system call they use is now using something called fdatasync. And I don't want to go into, if you just look that up in Google, you can get a rough idea as to why fdatasync is interesting compared to other type of commands that write. Indeed, in most cases, this eliminated, in my own experience, the need for DirectIO. But I'm actually working with a customer right now, it's the big A, Mike, where their checkpoint times, or they're in the ProMod, it's called duration. There's a little field called duration. And if you're not familiar with that field, it's good to become friends with it. Because if you see a duration of several seconds in ProMod during a checkpoint, that's the amount of time that your transaction activity is frozen for all users of that database. So we've got a customer, this big A, I'm not going to mention their name. Rich knows who they are as well. Anyway, their durations are in some cases, tens of seconds. Tens of seconds. But this is on a modern version of Progress. This is like on 10.2b.06. At least I think they're on 08 now, but we first started seeing this on 06. So we're right now exploring the possibility of using DirectIO, because the thing that's taking the most time is the syncing of the data, even though fdatasync is being used and is supposed to, or should for the most part, eliminate that kind of freezing. So anyway, so here we go.
So would you admit that DirectIO, I don't think so, with some exceptions?
Yes.
Okay.
But I thought I was careful to say, you can use it on every platform. That doesn't mean it's appropriate for every platform. So the only way to know is to, first of all, know if you have a problem. And that screen of ProMod with the duration is the easiest way to see if you have a problem. And if you do, then maybe DirectIO might be useful. All right, so this is another, I'll call it a myth, because in my own experience, it is a myth, where customers tell me, I do an index rebuild, and that gives me the same performance benefit as a dump and a load. Well, I don't agree. My own experience is contrary to that. I believe what you believe, or I believe you believe what you believe. Does that make sense? Well, anyway. But that's not my own experience. You know, the index rebuild only takes care of one part of the data access equation, the indexes. It doesn't take care of the data, doesn't deal with fragmentation, it doesn't take care of any of the other aspects of that. So, I don't know, does anybody here feel, and I won't ridicule you, but I just, like I say, I just have a different opinion, believe that index rebuilding or index compacting is as valuable as doing a full dump and load.
Well, maybe they're using type 2 data errors.
There we go. That's right, we're using type 2 data areas, I haven't dumped and loaded since that time.
Yeah, I would say they complement each other.
Yeah, okay.
So you index compact quarterly or every 6 months, and you dump and load every 2 years. They complement each other.
Okay.
I mean, it all depends on that. That's one of those, it all depends on the data. If you had a schema that doesn't change, and when you initially create your record, you're creating them all nicely in the primary key order, and they never really get updated after their initial creation, so you don't have to grow any records in fragment, then there probably isn't any gains to be made during the dump and load, because it's essentially a clean table just by how it functions.
Right, agreed, like a history table. All you do is append to it.
Right.
Yep, agreed, fully agreed. So, in fact, you could say your YMMV on a lot of these particular slides. But like I said, I'm just doing this to provoke thought more than say I know of all the myths in Progress and so forth. So here's another one. And again, I hear this enough that it's worthy of a bullet point. Is that, okay, we had some kind of a thing, I didn't call for help, but I know about this force access command into the database, so I used it. Then that sets something called the tainted flag. That's the little flag that says when you start the database or access it with pretty much any command, it'll say, you know, your database is damaged, you should dump and load it. It's error number 37, if you want to know the number. Look it up. That's why I know it well enough. That there's a few numbers that I know quite intimately. That's one of them. So they've learned somehow through the grapevine or the peg or whatever that if you do an index rebuild, that clears the tainted flag. So the analogy I like to use for that kind of behavior of forcing into the database and then index rebuilding to get rid of the tainted flag is like the bridge is out. There was some yellow tape or a yellow sign blocking the way to the bridge. That's the tainted flag, but it's just a piece of tape, so snip, and now you can do whatever you want to. You can see if you can make it across the bridge or not. Well, that's the problem, because when you use the capital F option, essentially what you're doing is you're throwing away the BI file. You're severing the relationship between the BI file and the database. You might say, well, there were no transactions active when I did this. There are still things that can break. So whenever you use capital F, you might as well pretend that you're smashing, you know, one of those SWAT team door smashers. In other words, instead of opening the door normally, you are breaking down the door. And an index rebuild doesn't put a new door back up. Now, having said that, you may think that minus F is evil because of the connotation that I described it in. Well, I don't know if everybody realizes that there are three different ways that you can use capital F. And I believe that some of them are evil, or at least evil is just a way I get people's attention. Let's just say they're you don't use them lightly. So the first one is the one I just talked about in the previous page. Forcing access into the database is using capital F on the truncate BI option of proutil. But in some cases, you may not have any other way to get into the database. So in that case, it's still evil, but it's the only option that you might have, potentially. Now on ProShut, using capital F on ProShut is the same as doing an emergency shutdown from the menu. Right? You've got unconditional shutdown and then emergency shutdown. So capital F is the functional equivalent or the command line equivalent of emergency shutdown. Now, most people can do an emergency shutdown and not have any side effects. But I think Michael will probably agree with me on this one that not every emergency shutdown will shut down nicely without hurting your database. Are we agreement on that one?
Joe,
okay.
I remember that very well.
Okay. So you would agree then that ProShut minus F is probably not something you should do on a regular basis.
You should not do it lightly.
Yep.
It corrupted the database in our case.
Yep.
And we had to go through a complete recovery process for that customer.
All right. Now the last one though is you can use minus F on ProMon. And I'll say this much. That isn't going to be evil necessarily, but if you need to use capital F on ProMon, the database is probably already either on its way down or is in a state where you're not going to be able to use it anyway. Because essentially what ProMon minus F does is it bypasses some of the locking mechanisms that ProMon would normally use when it takes a sniff of shared memory. So in general, you're not going to use capital F unless normal ProMon won't get in any other way. But you still want to get in there and see what you can see before the database does truly have to be put down. And I don't like to think of databases, giving them, human characteristics. But sometimes they take them on themselves. All right. Here's a great myth. When in version 9, when table move first came out, it was among certain people promoted as a way of doing an online reorg of the database. And, well, theoretically, yes, but there's theory and then there's practicality. The problem with table move, actually there's several of them. One is that it does the entire move as a single transaction. So that means your BI file will be as big as it needs to be to hold the entire table, right? Because it's got to be able to back that up. And if you're running after imaging, same thing goes for that. And by the way, you cannot disable after imaging while you're going through crash recovery. Everybody realize that? You can do it in multi-user mode, but you can't do it when you're in single-user mode, like running Truncate BI or something like that. Anyway, food for thought. The other problem is it locks the entire table for the duration of the move. And it, by the way, this is just moving the table. It's also got to rebuild the indexes on the wherever it's going to, wherever the indexes live. And this is the fun part. You say, well, I can get past the locking issues with no lock. Well, just for fun sometimes, do a table move of a large table and run a program that counts the records while the table move is going underway. And what you'll see is, let's say there's 1,000 records. And you have 1,000, then 900, 800, 700, 600, and then it'll go back up. In other words, you won't get the same number of records every time when you're using no lock during a table move. So any reports you run are totally bonkers, or potentially bonkers, because who knows how many records they were looking at during that process. So essentially, nearly all of these would disqualify, you know, all but a tiny or a relatively small table being moved. Metrics or measurements. Another one of my favorites is, you know, people who look in Promon at the buffer hit percentage and they say it's 99%. Wow, the documentation says that too. It's like, wow, I'm perfect. Well, maybe. Because let's say that 1% where you're not finding the data represents a billion IOs. For example, one of our customers, they're the ones down by you, Joe. I have a screenshot where they registered a trillion database requests over, I think it was about a 40-day period. It was the first time I'd ever seen a trillion in a progress metric. That's why I took a screenshot of it, because it was like, wow. So 1% of a trillion is a very, very, very big number. So that's the problem with percentages, particularly percentages that don't have decimal points, which Promon doesn't have, is that that 1% could represent a huge amount of data. So the problem with percentages is the closer you get to 100, mathematically speaking, the less meaningful they become. So that's why I like to use something called the hit ratio, which is the ratio of database requests to database reads, or in other words, the number of times you actually have to go to disk. To me, that's a much more meaningful number than a percentage that's at 99. I never trust a 99. It's almost too good. And along those same lines, why is it at 99 or maybe even 100? Well, this is something we see frequently at customer sites is there's a table with 50 records in it and it generates a billion reads over 5 hours. Does that sound like good code? Maybe, I kind of doubt it though. Well, the problem is, okay, we're finding that data in memory 100% of the time. So you think, hallelujah, that's exactly what I want to do. But see, that's not the only overhead that you're getting rid of. In other words, the disk I/O is gone in that case. It's in memory 100% of the time, yay. But every time you read that record or set of records, progress has to, by default, update the LRU chain, right? Because every time the LRU chain is a list of blocks that are ordered by least recently used to most recently used. So the minute you access that block, it's a most recently used block. Oh, I just accessed it again. Oh, back to the most recently block. Oh, block. So you end up putting that block on the same part of the LRU chain over and over and over and over and over and over again. So yes, you've got no disk IO, but your latch activity is off the charts in some cases. Now there's a couple ways to get around that. I don't have time to go into the details. There's the alternate buffer cache is one way, or the minus B2 parameter. And then the other way is there's a couple of parameters called LRU skip and LRU2 skips. Those are ways that you can at least, if you can't change the code, you can at least reduce the latching overhead of finding a common set of records in memory all the time. All right, here's another one. Progress scalability. We've got a small number of customers who have like 96 cores, 128 cores. The largest one I'm personally aware of has 192 cores. You know, net CPU cores when added up. You think, wow, that's a lot of power. But what we've learned is that progress doesn't really scale all that well with those kind of CPUs. And you would hope for at least linear or maybe near linear scaling based on, you know, the number of CPUs you have in ascending order. But the problem is that with latch activity, what's that term you use, Rich, ping-ponging?
Yeah.
Rich has coined this term called ping-ponging, where basically when you touch a latch on one of those cores, all the other CPUs have to be informed of, for example, that latch being released, because there may be somebody waiting for that latch down. Well, if you multiply that over, you know, that same activity over and over and over again, there's a lot of backplane communication going on, that the more cores you have, the worse that communication, or that more intense that communication becomes. So before you go out and double the number of CPUs you have, run a benchmark with your data and your application and your version of progress and see if it doesn't truly scale appropriately. You might be surprised a little bit. Now, this myth I don't hear very much anymore, but in the old days, like in the 90s and maybe the first part of the 21st century, is that progress doesn't work well with big databases. Well, maybe not Oracle-sized databases or Teradata-sized databases, but again, Breakpoint alone, and we certainly don't represent, you know, that big of a part of the progress community, we have multiple customers with multi-terabyte-sized databases. And they're still on progress. They're not migrating away because progress doesn't work well on large databases. So don't let anyone ever tell you that, at least within the progress community themselves. All right, so some potentially controversial ones. Workgroup database. Well, I don't know if you can buy a server anymore that doesn't have at least two cores. I know, my laptop's got four cores.
My phone has two cores.
So it's almost kind of a, I mean, it's a way to save money. So there certainly is an economic cost of enterprise versus workgroup database. But in terms of performance, like I say, you know, in the era when the one CPU was indeed one CPU and buying multiple CPUs was a relatively expensive proposition compared to today, then that might have been a much easier scale to weigh. But anymore, I don't know. But so if the economics are more important than everything else, then sure. But don't let the economics, play that big a part if you don't have to. Then my next one, this has got nothing to do really with technical stuff, but and unfortunately there are progress employees in the room, so they just have to close their eyes for the moment. Both Exchange and also this conference have these information exchanges, the database one, and there's a 4GL one usually, and to get feedback from the customer on what they'd like to see in the product. And they're always very good about saying, well, these are not guarantees, we'll put them in a spreadsheet or a PowerPoint presentation while you're telling them to us. But I always wonder what happens to those. Because based on my own experience with things that I've thought were highly prized, some of them have not shown up in the product, and I'm not sure they ever will. So if you've never gone to one of those, don't get your hopes too high. That's all I'm saying. Sometimes they do show up. It took a while. For example, one of the ones I always used to vote for was, what program is a user running? Well, we finally got that in version 10, even though I wanted it way back in version 7. So if you're patient enough, you might be able to outlast eventually the list gets down to so short that they've got to do it. Then the last one, this is a kind of miscellaneous weird one. So remote clients are always going to be a lot slower than self-service clients. Well, that used to be really true in the era of slower network topologies. When 100 megabits was not even on the horizon. in 1 megabit, or there are things like Token Ring and ARCNET and DECnet, LU6.2. Anybody date back to that era? Anybody even know what LU6.2 is? Oh, okay. Well, it's a network protocol. Well, the faster the network topology is, the less the delta is going to be between a self-service client and a remote client. And not only that, in 10.2b Service Pack 6, there were about 6 new startup options that were added for tuning remote client activity that did not exist for many, many years prior to that time. So I think that there certainly probably is a measurable delta, but it isn't nearly as substantial as it used to be in the old days. So sometimes it's just one of those, revisit it just to make sure that your assumptions are still correct. So I promised you a little bit of 4GL mythology. And this is another one of my favorites, is about the release statement. Because sometimes I get to do code reviews, and one of the things that makes me almost laugh out loud, but I can't because I'm being paid to look at the code, is I see release, and then a few lines later, release, and then release, 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 release. It's like they're like sprinkling release statements throughout the code, hoping, at least I think what they're doing is they're hoping that I find the right spot and I'll release a record lock that I'm trying to release. Now, confess, you've all done this, if you've coded in progress before. Yeah, I see some nodders out there. All right, maybe you haven't. It's just a matter of time. Or maybe now that you know how futile it is, you won't do it. But if you're one of those release sprinklers,
it works for me one time.
Or yeah, if I put one every other line in the code, yeah, I might get there someday.
It works eventually.
Exactly. It's just a matter of scale, right? You just have to find that balancing point of 14, is it 14 releases or 12? Well, first of all, release does have the ability to release locks in certain circumstances. It can release share locks outside of a transaction. You cannot release even a share lock, even the lowly little share lock, inside of a transaction. And that is not documented, by the way, at least the last time I looked at the release data. What release will do in that case is when the transaction ends, when the share lock might normally be downgraded to it wouldn't be downgraded because there's nothing to downgrade it to. Where it might normally not be released due to the record scope, it will release it in that case. But really what release, I believe the intent of release was to flush the record from the local record buffer of the client, which has nothing to do with the lock table at all. In other words, I think what happens is the program says, okay, if I use the available function, the record is not available, but it's still locked. Well, how can that be? Well, it can certainly be, because there's two different places where that record was living. One is locally, and the other one is in shared memory, and when it's in shared memory, the lock table has, shall we say, final say. Another one of my favorites, and this is one I was guilty of probably for about the first 5 years of my progress life, is thinking that mandatory in the dictionary, that attribute at the field level, meant that you had to enter something in the field. Well, doesn't mean anything like that. Basically means that the unknown value is either allowed or not allowed. Period. That's all. Oops, wrong way, sorry. All right, here's another one. And by the way, remember, I've been with progress for 30 years. So, it's like a marriage. There's certain things I love about my wife, and there's certain things that I wish I could have changed 30 years ago. But same thing with progress. So one of those is this treadmill of development methodologies that come out every few years. Starting back a long time ago with the shell, anybody go back to the shell methodology era? Okay, yeah, a few of you. And you've got ADM1 and then of course ADM2, twice as good as ADM1.
In this case it was.
Well, anyway, let's just say sometimes, not always, progress doesn't always know the best way to use their own tools. Not always, but sometimes. So I think that's why there's a relatively healthy market for frameworks. Oh, in fact, I learned about a new one at lunch called Fusion. It's a new They in fact, she told me not to use the F word. Because apparently framework has now kind of a dirty connotation in the development methodology world. All right, a couple of historical myths. If you've been with Progress for a while, you may have heard back in the 90s there was a rampant rumor that Microsoft was going to buy Progress. And the stock price...
Great. I remember that.
Was that great?
97.
Yeah, if you were holding Progress stock, it was probably wonderful. In fact, it was probably you. Since you say, well, it was great. Wow, I made $100 million.
It was great.
And then you shorted it because you knew that the rumor would be debunked originally, and then you made another $100 million. Well, anyway, so I don't think there was any truth to that, but it was a great rumor. Then, this is trivia. It's not really what I call mythology, but I wanted to throw it in just because it's kind of interesting. There's two epic dates in the Progress world. There's one for the database and there's one for the 4GL. And they're different for both of them. By the way, the epic date, if you don't know what it is, it's essentially it's an arbitrary point in time chosen to be a reference point. It's just essentially a line in the sand. So for the database epic date, it's May the 2nd, 1950. Now why such an odd time? Was there like a full eclipse of the moon or something? You know, a lunar eclipse?
It's somebody's birthday.
It's somebody's birthday. It's Chip Zeering's birthday, who was one of the original founders. He's not been with the company for quite some time, but it's his birthday.
Because he sold stock when Microsoft
was going to buy the company. Yeah, but I think Chip had his own money. But anyway, and day zero in the 4GL is 4714 BC. Now that date actually does have some scientific meaning. There's like three different calendars, I don't remember the names of them, that all intersect on that particular date. So it actually does have a meaning, I guess, if you're a student of time. Then a couple more and then we're almost done. By the way, these slides show up on the Pug Challenge website afterwards. Not like immediately afterwards, but Tom usually pings on us and says, so you don't have to take perfect notes. Got it?
Yeah.
All right. So 5-minute rule for database conversion. In other words, Progress's goal, and they've been very good about keeping it, is when you convert a database from, let's say, version 9 to 10, 10 to 11, that it will take no more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, there's a reason for that. And Gus told me this over, I'm actually staying at Gus's house, and he tends to loosen up when he gets a few beers in him. So this one came out. So basically, some of you may, again, if you go back this far, there was a new index manager implemented in version 7 where you could do word indexes, the index entries were compressed. I mean, it was really cool. But at the same time, they removed the old index manager, which Gus now believes was a mistake because that means to do the conversion, all the indexes had to be built in the new format. So essentially, an index rebuild equivalent had to occur to convert a V6 to version 7 database. And unfortunately, with large databases, that wasn't so quick. Anyway, trivia. And this is actually one of my customers back at that time. They were the first customer whose single .db file, this is before the era of multi-volume databases, was approaching 2 gigabytes, which was the limit. And so Progress implemented multi-volume databases, I mean, for the community overall as well, but specifically so this customer didn't hit the wall. Anyway, their name is, I mean, they're not in business anymore, so I don't think they're, you know, revealing their name is going to do anything. So that same company, though, even after multi-volume was implemented, there was a couple of things that didn't get taken for, it was related to a variable extent growing to 2 gig. That caused a bug that caused them to crash. And then there was another bug related after that one to 4 gig because that was the limit of a 32-bit integer. So this one customer had some exciting times because they had probably the fastest growing Progress database in the world at that time. Then some famous quotes. So Clyde Kessel, who is also one of the original founders of Progress Software, who's also an avid biker like me, is accused, even though he denies it. Whoops, what did I do? Sorry. Was accused of this, or overheard saying this, and he denies it. But anyway, Clyde is a very, if you've ever met him, Clyde doesn't sugarcoat things, shall we say. Well, and you can see by that statement that he wasn't sugarcoating things. You're too stupid to be using our products. I've wanted to say that myself many times, but anyway. And this one has nothing to do with progress, but it's one of my favorite quotes because it was the beginning of the end for Digital Equipment Corporation. The CEO at that time was Ken Olson. This is back in the late 80s or early 90s, called Unix Snake Oil. Well, that was pretty much the beginning of the end for proprietary operating systems. And finally, now you think this is funny, there's at least historical fact that one of the marketing people only lasted about 6 days. That was a while ago. But they certainly do seem to have some high turnover in that particular part of the organization. Well, I ran out of time, so if we want to debunk some further myths, come by the show, look me up. I'll put them in this presentation if I ever do it again, if they're funny or interesting. And thank you very much for coming. I hope this was at least semi-amusing to you.